this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our guest this week is playwright Keith Huff, who wrote one of the two great plays last year to come out of Chicago. One everyone knows is August Osage County, which is running on Broadway. But the other one has a chance to really go far. It's called A Steady Rain, and it's going to open this week at the Royal George Theater, and I'm privileged to have Keith Huff, the playwright. Hello, Keith.
Hi, glad to be here.
So tell us now about Steady Rain. And first, my first question is, since it's a cop play, do you have a police background?
I married into a police family. My wife's father was a lifelong policeman. Harold Heber, he rose to commander of Area 5. And then my brother-in-law is a retired police detective. He's now working for the in some ultra-secret wing of the Department of Defense. But he's retired, but he was a cop his whole life.
Okay. Now, what got you to write A Steady Rain?
Well, the germ of the play came from an article I read in the New York Times about the two Milwaukee policemen who turned one of Jeffrey Dahmer's victims back over to him. And it was really, obviously, I think everyone remembers it as a horrific crime, a horrific serial crime. I guess crimes would be the best way to say it. It struck me as odd that the policemen were on trial. And I started to think about why would we put policemen on trial? When we have the killer in hand, obviously they made a mistake. Obviously there was a lapse in judgment, but it seemed they had to go this extra length to try to make sense of something that made no sense.
Well, you know, that happened in Chicago with Gacy.
Right.
Had Gacy. I have a police background. I knew a couple of the detectives that worked on it. And I remember them. One of them telling me, "We know this guy is killing little hustler boys, but we can't prove it. And until we can, we can't touch him."
Yeah.
So those things do happen. So that was the germ of the story.
Right. And there, another aspect of that with the Northern Illinois University shootings recently, there was a big PR push—not a PR push—but there were some articles, a big front page on the Sun-Times. The man's girlfriend, the shooter's girlfriend, said he is not a monster. And it just seemed to be another extreme way that we as a society try to make sense of something that's uncivilized, that's barbaric, that's horrific. And but particularly with these two cops, did their jobs, their careers, their self-esteem really need to be put on the line because we were confronted with something so horrific?
All right. Without giving that away, so tell us about the setting. It's a two-person play, and about these two cops, why we care, because I thought you captured the essence of a couple of types of cops that everybody with a police background, including myself, can relate to. I can name someone who's like Denny and someone who's like what's the other guy's name? Joey. Yeah. So tell us how that emerged.
I guess from my not only was my father-in-law a policeman and my brother-in-law was a policeman, but I've known several policemen as well in a work environment. One of them was remember when the Greylord arrests were coming down, the indictments were coming down, he was scared to death because he was implicated somehow and he was just frantic. And he would speak very frankly about police corruption and ways that he could play the system to his advantage. I'm obviously not going to say his name.
Yeah.
But it sort of struck me as odd to hear someone almost brag about it. Ways that he could pretend that he was injured so he could collect disability and then do another job during the day while he was supposed to be out sick.
Yeah, thank God those days are over. But there was, in my background too, goes back a number of years in police work. But you captured, there were people like that.
But then there are the opposite, the Serpicos, the people who say, no, we can't let the system get away from us. It's a slippery slope. We've got to, you know, we have a lot of responsibility to be the stand on the barrier between uncivilized behavior and civilized behavior. So we've got to support the civilized behavior. We can't, you know, give in and participate in the element that we're trying to really protect society from.
So did you do any ride-alongs or whatever? Because you, if I were to say that you had a 20-year police background and people go see the play, they're going to walk out and say, well, sure, this guy, you know, he was, I mean, you have captured it.
No, I've never done any ride-alongs. I think I was a little too nervous about that. But when we did the Barrow Group workshop before we came to Chicago or did the play in Chicago, the actors came here and they did ride-alongs with the police. And, you know, the Chicago police were great about it. We thought it was going to be a two-hour ride-along, and they ended up taking the actors out for, they must have been out for 8 to 12 hours, and they took them to a planning meeting where they actually planned the build, where they were going to, what do you call it when you surround a building and then you're going to
do a raid? Yeah.
Yeah, they were going to raid a building, and they took the guys along with them, and
that had to be interesting.
Yeah.
So tell us how you developed the two characters. Let's talk a little bit about the two characters, because what you have captured is the reality that a lot of writers miss. Everything isn't black and white. Denny is not a bad guy, not a great. I mean, he's a multiple character, and he is the boss of the car, which is very realistic. When there are two men that work together, somebody is the boss,
mm-hmm.
and that always seems to happen. Otherwise, you know, they both want to drive, and that's a little hard to do.
The alpha partner.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And Joey is the guy. His role is to sort of keep Denny from exploding, going off the deep end.
Right.
So tell us how you arrived at those, because those characters used to exist. I want to think that in modern police work, with the better training, that there aren't as many Dennys around, thank God.
Right. Well, we can only hope.
Yeah.
I think the rule of thumb that I had all along was we've seen the stereotype policeman, and they never seemed really human or humane to me. So that was something I kept forefront in my mind was, let's remember these are human beings. They're not defined by their jobs. Their jobs certainly are an integral part of their lives and impact their lives in hugely significant ways. But they also have families. They have psychological complexity. They have desires. They get hurt. They laugh. They're human beings. And I have said this before, but I had no intention to romanticize them as policemen and no intention to denigrate them by presenting them as stereotypes.
No, you didn't.
I just said they're human beings.
So yeah, and
portray the human.
Well, like Denny was like so many cops of that era, and let's say, I would say an era of 10, 20 years ago, like use of force or breaking of the rules. They had their own sort of street justice and their own sort of rules and their own rationalizations for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they could be really kind on one hand, and on the next one they could, you know, grab a guy by the ear and hurt him or give him a good punch in the face.
Right. Right. And in the, you know, just to jump and look at New York in the 70s, there were a lot of people who thought criminal justice system, but the police department was so thoroughly corrupt, it could not be saved.
Yeah, that's true.
And in a way, years later, we're finding out that Chicago had some of those same issues with the Burge stories coming out with William Hanhart. being indicted and now in prison?
Well, when I joined the police department, we were the first group of college grads after they had had some scandals where they'd put a few captains and commanders in jail.
Oh, okay.
And part of it was the lack of professionalism, the pay. You know, in today's money, if you were paying people $10,000 a year when the average salary is, say, $30,000, and then you want them to be honest and you give them a badge and a gun, you're just asking for it.
Right.
That's what New Orleans is now facing, too. So if you undertrain them, underpay them, you're going to get the bottom of the barrel, not the sharpest guys.
Yeah, and I remember seeing one of my father-in-law's pay stubs after he died. We were cleaning out his house. And this was in the 60s sometimes, maybe toward the late, mid-60s. He was making $3,000 a year.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was good money back then, but...
Well, I remember a very good friend of mine's father made... as a police officer, made half of what my father made, and my father didn't do that well working for the phone company. Yeah, it was, you know, it was the thing. Teachers and police were tremendously underpaid. But I think your characters, I think Denny is a product of that era, because you don't really set it in an era.
Right.
And I assume you, do you mean it to be contemporary or what?
Well, obviously, I used the Dahmer incident as a touchstone, but then I took a huge poetic liberty moving an incident like that to Chicago. And in doing so, I didn't set it when that took place in Milwaukee. I just thought there were comparable, horrible things that happened here in Chicago, so I thought it justified to make that leap. So no, I never did specifically say it's 1990 or 2000 or
Well, what's been the reaction of police? Because I said in my initial review of it, and I still believe that, I don't think your play is anti-cop or anti-police officer. I think it's realism, and I think every police officer serving today and every commander should see that the play, if for one thing, to make sure that there aren't any Denny's still around. And if so, you know, let's do something about it. I hope the new superintendent comes and see it, because it's a model of what he doesn't want, but that he may have to be dealing with.
Yeah, we there was, and I'm sorry, I don't recall what precinct or district it was, but we had a captain come, and he ordered everyone in his district to go see the play.
Great.
When we were running over Chicago Dramatists. For he didn't say what his motivation was, but he did it. And the other policemen were—they're just so generous, and they're so kind to stay after the show and talk to the actors and talk to me if they can find me. we were doing the show the other night. We had our first preview, and some policemen said, "You know, we never say patrol car." In Chicago, we say squad.
That's right.
Squad or squad car. And I have three instances of when they say patrol car, and I'm going to change it.
Good.
Because they're right, and I'd like it to be.
See, I was forgiving on that because you got so many things right.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, you didn't have, you know, it was so accurate that I could live with that. But same thing with its district rather than precinct.
Right, I changed all the, my brother-in-law actually caught me on that. He goes, precincts are, that's New York. You know, we're districts here, so. Plus it's, so often it's TV, portrayal of the police department. They always have to say precinct.
Yes. So the basis of your story was the Daimler incident, but.
That was a germ.
It's a germ, but
yeah.
To me, the essence of cop life of Denny and how he's just trying to provide for his family, and then when there's the incident that involves his family, how true that is. There's not a cop I know that won't staunchly defend his own family.
I think it's part and parcel of the American character.
Yes. I like the Joey character too, and how realistic that is. In fact, I knew an incident where two partners, where the one partner was madly in love with the other one's wife. So that's not too far-fetched.
I know it's unusual you say that, because a policeman came up to me after one of the shows, and he told me that he knew of several incidences like that, where the one partner ended up with the other partner's wife. I was surprised to hear that.
Yeah, that I know a couple of cases where that has happened, you know, down the line where the divorces, you know, go on, yeah. So you got to be proud of this work.
I'm very proud of it, and we're for the Royal George production, we open on March 4th. We're continuing to fine tune it and you know, make little adjustments just to make it, you know, play a little sharper and a little more clean.
Well, good. I can't wait, because one of the things that you did that was very risky, but you got away with it with great writing and with the two actors, we have to talk about them also,
okay.
Is this is pretty much of a series of monologues where they're breaking the fourth wall and talking right to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And to sustain that and to hold your interest and you have you on the edge of your seats is a testimony to terrific writing and excellent acting.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, the actors were...
So tell us who your two players are in this.
Okay. The actors are Randy Steinmeier. He plays Denny. And I'll talk about him a little bit first.
Okay.
When we did developmental readings at Chicago Dramatists, we did two of them. Randy was playing the Joey character.
Oh, interesting.
And the character of Denny was originally portrayed by Troy West, who ended up going to New York and Broadway with August Osage County. So when we were going into production, Troy found out that he was going to be going to New York, so we were left without a Denny. And Russ and I have known Randy for years, and we thought, you know, Troy is just a master at playing that rage and that
mm-hmm.
anger.
He sure is, yes.
But then we thought, what if we cast somebody like Randy, who's just an eminently lovable guy in person, and I think on stage, and asked him to play a character like Denny, what would that casting a little bit against type do for the show? And the thing I think that Randy brought to the show was a level of empathy and compassion.
That's right. You like him.
Right. And
flaws and all, you basically like him.
Yeah, it's because even when somebody is hurt or killed who he has no personal investment in, Randy just feels that as a human being. He has an enormous sense of empathy and compassion, and it's just a terrific dimension that Randy brought to the character of Denny. And
so
I
whose
think,
decision was that, you, yours, or Russ? Or?
Well, there are lines in the play where he goes, he's talking about the Vietnamese boy and what happens to him, and he goes, "Don't you think that breaks my heart?" It does. It really does. And the cues are in the script. And Randy took it and ran with it. So it was, you know, one of those collaborative elements that came together, I thought, quite nicely.
Okay, and tell us about the other.
And the actor playing Joey is a wonderful Chicago actor named Peter DeFaria. And Peter's been working in the off-loop theater scene for probably as long as I've been writing, upwards 15, 20 years here in Chicago. And it's a personal thrill of mine to see him. He's gone equity now with the commercial production. And I think he also brought a sort of Midwestern, I don't want to call it naivety, but
almost simple, but without being sounding negative. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
uncomplicated.
Candor.
Yeah.
It's like a streetwise openness and candor that you know, not being cagey, not always playing an angle, but wearing his heart on his sleeve to a certain extent, and
he comes off quite truthful.
Yeah, that's the impact of it, and I think that's Peter that brought all that to the role. Just a credibility, and again, you like him. You just like him.
Well, I hope these two guys are along for the ride.
Oh yeah. Well, of course they're back in the Royal George production, and I sat through the first preview, and they've got it back, and it's a pleasure to see them do it again, especially after they've sat with it for 6 weeks. When we ran it at Chicago Dramatists, now we're seeing even more nuances, and it's just becoming richer the more they do it.
Well, that's great, because it's quite a powerful story.
Oh, well, thanks.
Yeah, and I really, really believe that that this show could move on.
We're scheduled to go to New York and London.
Oh, you are? Very good.
Yeah, and mention has also been made of possibly taking it to L.A. before we go to London and New York. Yeah, the producers who optioned the material to produce it commercially, Frank Giro, Ray Gaspard, and John O'Giro, had originally acquired the material to take it to London and New York. But when we closed the show at Chicago Dramatists, we had a waiting list of people who wanted to see the show. We had to turn so many people away. So they thought, well, there's a waiting list, and we've got great reviews and great local actors. Why not put it back on its feet in Chicago before we...
Well, I know Russ is very strong on doing that for Playwrights. Tell us about how it is to work with him.
With Russ?
Yeah.
Well, I've known Russ for so long, and he's always been a terrific mentor and a huge supporter of my work. And of course, Chicago Dramatists as an institution is a great place for a writer to take things and put them on their feet and find out what works and what doesn't and go fix them and come back and do it again. And it's nice to have an incubator developmental organization like that where you can...
Yeah, we do really need it, and Russ has done a terrific job with that organization. And he's directing this production also.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the same. Everyone's the same. The same design team, same cast, same director.
Well, I certainly hope that as the producers are smart enough to keep these two guys in the cast.
Okay.
Because so often, you know, they think they have to have a big name or a New York actor or something, or, you know, and then they just take what was a great play that worked and just ruin it. I've seen it happen.
Yeah, well, I think what we've learned is we've seen two local Chicago shows go to New York with their Chicago casts intact. August Osage County, of course, and then The Adding Machine went.
That's right.
I don't know, excuse me, I don't know if that was the original cast, but I believe it's all Chicago actors.
I think it's pretty much the original cast, yeah.
And that just got a terrific review in the New York Times, and I think should do quite well. So it's just a joy and an honor to be among that company.
So tell us about the run, a little commercial for A Steady Rain. It's at the Royal George Theater.
Mm-hmm.
What days are you running?
We're running 8 performances a week. So we have Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday performances at 7:30, and I haven't memorized the schedule yet, but I do have the postcard on my wall here. So it's Friday at 8:00, and then Saturday at 5 and 8:00, and Sunday at 2 and 5:00.
Wow, what a stretch for both actors doing 4 in 2 days, because folks, they leave it all out on the stage, because it's quite an emotional ride for them.
I know, that should be interesting, seeing that second show of the day and where they are with it.
Well, that's why they're professionals.
Yeah.
Yeah, that they can do it, and I'm sure they all have their way of doing it. Well, I just think that it is just as an example of great Chicago theater, and so let's talk about your background now, because this play is a little different than some of the other things you've written.
Yeah. In fact, for as accepting as audiences have been of the storytelling structure of A Steady Rain, I think of it as fairly experimental. Two people telling a story and not really any stage action other than the action that the audience is asked to imaginatively recreate. Before this, I did The Bird and Mr. Banks at Live Bait. I did several productions of a play called Birdsend in Chicago. And recently I did a play called Gray City, which is about two undergrads at the University of Chicago. And I did a play, sort of a wacky play called The Age of Cynicism or Karaoke Night at the Hog at Chicago Dramatists.
Tell us about that one. I mean, the name alone's got me interested.
Well, it was basically a two couples interacting in the way that the two couples interact in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And one of the couples just goes to karaoke night regularly. And we tried something really wildly experimental again, is that we, between the scenes, we would call people down from the audience to perform karaoke, and it was really unusual.
But it's also risky.
Yeah, where else could you do this in Chicago, where we, you know, we're so big on improv, it required a lot of improv,
and we do experiment here. We like to push the envelope.
Yeah. But it was a lot of fun. I hope it gets another life somewhere.
Okay. What do you consider your most successful work to date?
Well, this one. This is the first play I've ever had move on to a commercial production and to be optioned to go to New York and London.
How exciting is that?
Well, it's a breakthrough.
I
have a huge stack of plays.
Isn't it funny, after a hit, how much better those old plays are?
Yeah, people are starting to ask for them and take a second look at them, or to call and say, well, what else do you have? So that's very encouraging.
And who do you consider your mentors or your models?
My mentors or my models? Well, of course, I like the big three classic American guys: Tennessee Williams, Eugene O'Neill, and Arthur Miller. But I also really appreciate the edgier, more contemporary writers like Sam Shepard and David Mamet, and even Tracy Letts. I just really enjoy the...
Oh, Tracy should be up there. If he wins a Pulitzer, which a lot of people are hinting at, and a couple of Tonys to go along with his Jeff Awards, he might be in that class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he certainly deserves it.
Yes, he did.
I don't know if you curse writers if you say they're going to get a Pulitzer.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that. So maybe I shouldn't.
I've seen people put it in the papers. Just someone wrote, just mail him his Pulitzer already.
Yeah, I have. Well, I know Chris Jones likes it, and he gets a vote on the Pulitzer committee. So Chris also liked your play quite a bit.
Chris has been a huge supporter of the play. Every step of the way, he's done a lot of features on the play. I think there's an interview with Frank Giro, the producer, and Chris.
Yeah, on Chris's blog, I did read that.
And I think that's in the paper today.
Oh, good.
He's been a huge force behind the momentum that this play eventually gathered.
You were telling me before we get on the air about some of the reaction of some of the cops. How tell us about that?
Well, it's been really positive. I was a little nervous about how policemen would react, because I never did really try to romanticize them or glamorize them. But then I don't think I never tried to bash them or put them down either.
And that's what they appreciate, that you was an honest portrayal.
Yeah. And how can you not like honesty or truthfulness?
Well, when I was walking out, I didn't go opening night to your play because of a schedule conflict, but when I did see it, when I was walking out, there were a couple of old retired cops. I mean, I can just tell. I didn't have to ask them. And I heard their comments are saying, well, that guy got it right. It's like he almost had a microphone in some of the squads.
Well, that's an enormous compliment.
But what didn't recently you have a couple of cops come and see it, and then they were giving notes or talking to the actors?
Oh, right. This was just Wednesday. It was our first preview. There were six policemen, and they cornered the actors after the show, and they were telling them notes such as, we don't call it a patrol car, we call it a squad car. The whole Dahmer incident, they said, why have you transposed that to Chicago? the reaction that struck me as interesting is, why'd you put that on Chicago Cops? We've got enough to deal with already. And I think I did it more because it expresses just the universal, complex, I don't even know a word for it, paradoxes, conundrums that police have to deal with on a daily basis.
And I also like the way you dealt with, and we won't give it away, with taking responsibility. Somebody's got to take a fall for a mistake. That whole sequence was played out, again, realistically, and I related to it. You got it right.
Oh, well, thanks. I don't know how correct it is that someone needs to take a fall for that, but it definitely says something about a person's character when they step up to the plate and say.
But cops are somewhat bureaucrats on that level.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, the whole, it's saving face and someone has to take the fall. That just seems to be how the mechanism works. And you captured that, and I think a lot of policemen who see the play will relate to that.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. Fourth on your opening.
Great.
Yeah,
great.
I got to see it again, and hopefully, I think Chris will probably be there if he's in town. And we want to help the play because it's a beautiful piece of theater. It's realistic. It's Chicago all the way, and you should be very proud of this work.
Oh, I am. I'm very proud. And and I hope the people who didn't get a chance to see it at Chicago Dramatists, the short run we had, can come over to the Royal George and see it.
Yes. Well, thank you for the interview.